The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
There's a reason that we live so far from Hollywood, in the country looking hard to find a home, with nothing perfect or considered.
Bonjour, Hive Canada. It's Hugh Hewitt in the ReliefFactor.com studio inside of the Beltway on Wednesday, June 17th in the year of the plague, 2020. Good morning to you. There's lots to cover today. There is shooting on the India-China border. By the end of the day, there might be a war. I will come back to that. I've got a guest in the studio this morning, John Schroeder. He is here inside the Beltway on a Butler University recruiting trip. They're looking for 5'9 guards who can't shoot in the second half. As any of you know, the Butler Bearcats or the Butler Bulldogs, whatever their name is, they usually go to the NC2A tournament. This year, they didn't go. And so they're trying to really re-up their number of people on their bench. And so those 5'9 ace shooters who clank it off the rim, that's what they really need. So John is welcome in the studio this morning. Let me do the rundown for you. He's shaking his head. I just report the news. In this hour, it's called the rundown. I just report the news. India-China border standoff turns violent with 20 Indian soldiers dead. India said 20 of its soldiers died in a clash with Chinese troops with two country disputed border in the Himalayan mountains. That's tough fighting terrain to begin with, but they're not normally a lot of dead soldiers when they move around. They've been having fist fights, actual fist fights on the border as the means of resolving this. The New York Times headline is worst clash in decades on disputed India-China border. You know, China has had a resurgence of coronavirus in Beijing. Totalitarian regimes like China's look to divert the attention of their people when there is a domestic crisis. So do not be surprised if we have one of China's famous short, sharp wars, as they've waged in Tibet, with India, with Vietnam, the shelling of Taiwan way back in the 50s. The invasion of Korea was not short and sharp, but it was, they are not hesitant to use force, and the mask has slipped from the CCP. There's a Hugh Hewitt column in the Washington Post. It's on the front page of the Washington Post today. The fourth rescue bill needs to repair damage done to the economy and national security is the headline the Post gave it. And I want you to hear it first thing, because I want you to send it to your friends, especially in light of the fact that we've got a very tense situation in India and China. Two nuclear powers, by the way, neither of which I think would hesitate to use them if they thought it was necessary for their national advantage. President Trump, by right, was effectively denied a first term by a small band of senior law enforcement personnel and perhaps some in the intelligence community who from the start wanted him hamstrung or worse. His accomplishments on the judiciary, the military rebuild, and the deregulation make his accomplishments even more remarkable in light of this attempt at a coup. Our economic recovery is needed again. The first one was done by January, the blue-collar boom, and then the Chinese Communist Party allowed the virus to escape from China and crippled the world economy. So the president who did it once should be the one to do it again, not return to the Biden-Obama entropy. Public confidence, I write, in the president should grow because for the first time in his tenure, there is growing alignment on priorities among the big five. Vice President Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Attorney General William Barr, Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, and National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien. Pence, Pompeo, and Barr are principals, of course. Meadows and O'Brien are staff. But if those two staffers aren't on the same page, the gears grind in the West Wing, and the president's vision cannot be implemented. It is now an article of faith within the West Wing that not since then Chief of Staff James Baker and then National Security Advisor William Clark worked together in Ronald Reagan's first term have these two officials been in such harmony with the principals and with each other. My reporting tells me the West Wing believes $40 billion is needed in COVID-19-related defense spending. Now, I don't know what Mark Esper, the Secretary of Defense, thinks, and I don't know what the Chiefs of Staff think, but the Pentagon needs to get on board with this and push the measures everyone else, including the Commander-in-Chief, President Trump, have rallied around. The Pentagon has slow-rolled the president on the naval buildup he wants. There is still, 40 months into the presidency, no plan for the 355-ship Navy that Trump campaigned on. 40 months, no plan. The West Wing now wants additional spending for defense, both to respond to the needs that have arisen from the pandemic and to watch the nation, to match the nation from whence the virus came, the People's Republic of China. They want $12 billion to cover overruns in defense production caused directly by the virus. They need $6 billion for the defense industrial base where there are single source suppliers to make sure they're not bought by or meddled by the Chinese. They need a dozen F-35B for the Marine Corps. They need a dozen F-35As for the Air Force. They need another Virginia-class attack submarine, which is the instrument of power of choice in the South China Sea. Some say two. I'll settle for one. They need an array of Coast Guard ships. And people, when I sent the column over to the Post, an editor said to me, Coast Guard ships, those are for the United States. I said, no, they're for the littoral first chain islands in the Pacific. People don't understand that. All of these platforms will eventually deploy to parts of the Pacific to confront China, which is attempting to dominate not just India at this day, but the South China Sea every day. I asked Tom Cotton on yesterday's program whether my sources were good. He said, I would say you're very well sourced indeed. I even know that the White House wants to extend the sea lives of the Ticonderoga-class cruisers and the Oliver Hazard Perry frigates, which are in the Philadelphia shipyard and not at sea. Alignment is a hot new phrase. People in Cleveland know what alignment means. That means where your owner, your general manager, your head coach, and everybody else in the organization shares one vision. They agree to one set of principles. Alignment has never, ever happened on this show because I don't have a producer. But if I had a producer, we'd have alignment on this show. There is finally alignment in the White House between the president, the vice president, and the secretary of state, the national security advisor, and the chief of staff. And that's because they finally cleared away the Russia hoax. They've finally gotten out of impeachment, and they are dealing with unprecedented crises all at once. Whenever Congress gets around to appropriating the next huge chunk of funds to cope with the pandemic, I conclude my column with, and its aftershocks, likely a little before Labor Day, we will learn whether that alignment holds and the president can make sure that the fourth rescue bill seeks to repair damage done to national security. That's over at the Washington Post. I hope you send it everywhere, especially to Congress, because there are some Republicans who don't want to add to the deficit. $40 billion is nothing compared to the $4 trillion we're spending. 1%, right? 1% of the money that we're spending should go to national defense. It used to be 4 to 5% of every bill ought to go to national defense. 1%. But there are some knuckleheads in the Democratic Party who do not want to spend. They'll spend trillions of dollars for relief and not a penny for defense. It's remarkable. The good news yesterday, U.S. retail sales rose 18% in May. We were expecting at this hour yesterday a 7% hike in retail sales. So let me check the markets. Brought to you by Birch Gold. You should diversify. The market dropped 1,700 points in one day last week. It doesn't bother anyone with a diversified portfolio. You diversify by going to HughGold.com or by sending my name, Hugh, to 474747, texting Hugh, H-U-G-H, to 474747 or going to HughGold.com. Gold this morning is at 1721. That is higher than the 1400 when I first recommended it. If inflation returns, as I suspect it will, you'll wish you got in. The 10-year Treasury has inched up to 0.76. That means that the 3.1517 interest rates you've been getting on 30-year money, that's going to go away pretty soon. So you got to get out there and buy a house. But right now is the time to buy gold. Birch Gold will help you diversify into a rollover. where physical gold is stored in their vaults, and you have your name on it, and it actually belongs to you. 10 to 20% of your retirement in physical precious metals, or buy physical precious metals for your safety deposit box. The Dow went up 526 points yesterday. The NASDAQ went up 170. The S&P went up 58. Across the sea, it's a mixed market this morning. England thinks it's going to be a good day. Germany thinks it's really only down 0.05%, so it doesn't know what it's doing. Oil is off at 37, but like I say, gold at 1721, good entry point. Birch Gold via HughGold.com. When I come back, I'll also check in for you what the president had to say about police reform. And understand this from the British Telegraph. Private schools set to ignore the government and open in September, come what may. The private schools of the United Kingdom are going back to school because, as anyone who reads the data knows, children are not at risk. Some of their older teachers, if they're over 55, maybe over 60, certainly over 70, should not go back to school. But the children should be back in school in the United States. And if they're not, look at your local union officials and call your local school board, because it's ridiculous. I'll be right back, America. Wednesday morning edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show.
These changes in latitudes, changes in attitudes, nothing remains quite the same. Through all of the islands and all of the highlands, if we couldn't laugh, we would all go insane.
Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt, the President of the United States, signed an executive order on police reform yesterday. Here is the first thing he had to say. Cut number 7, Donald Trump.
And thank you all for being here as we take historic action to deliver a future of safety and security for Americans of every race, religion, color, and creed. We're joined today by law enforcement professionals and community leaders. Though we may all come from different places and different backgrounds, we're united by our desire to ensure peace and dignity and equality for all Americans. I've just concluded a meeting with incredible families, just incredible families that have been through so much. The families of Ahmaud Arbery, Botham Jean, Antoine Rose, Jamel Roberson, Adriana Jefferson, Michael Dean, Darius Tarver, Cameron Lamb, and Everett Palmer. These are incredible people, incredible people. And it's so sad. Many of these families lost their loved ones in deadly interactions with police. To all of the hurting families, I want you to know that all Americans mourn by your side. Your loved ones will not have died in vain. We are one nation. We grieve together and we heal together. I can never imagine your pain or the depth of your anguish, but I can promise to fight for justice for all of our people.
He went on to say this, cut number 8, again with the families of many victims of excessive force by the police in front of him, cut number 8.
Lamb and Everett Palmer. These are incredible people, and it's so sad. Many of these families lost their loved ones in deadly interactions with police. To all of the hurting families, I want you to know that all Americans mourn by your side. Your loved ones will not have died in vain. We are one nation. We grieve together and we heal together. I can never imagine your pain or the depth of your anguish, but I can promise to fight for justice for all of our people. And I gave a commitment to all of those families today with Senator Tim Scott and Attorney General Bill Barr.
Now, the president is going to continue on today to back Tim Scott. And I've just tweeted out, I hope you follow me over at HughHewitt.com, Tim Scott earlier this morning said tomorrow morning, that's today, at 9:30 a.m., we will introduce the Justice Act, focusing on police reform, accountability, and transparency. The American people have spoken, and we hear you. Senator John Cornyn 3 minutes ago said, shocking thought, Democrats could allow the chamber to debate Scott's bill and try to amend it. This would be the legislative process working. Democrats could force some tough votes for the GOP. But as we have seen in Politico playbook this morning, Democrats have pegged Tim Scott's bill as not going far enough. They are going to refuse to consider the bill. So police reform is not going to happen because Democrats want it as an issue, not as a problem to be solved. I hope people understand that's the radical nature of the Democratic Party. That is the radical nature of the Democratic Party. This is Donald Trump talking about what could be done. Cut number 9.
Americans can achieve anything when we work together as one national family. To go forward, we must seek cooperation, not confrontation. We must build upon our heritage, not tear it down. And we must cherish the principles of America's founding as we strive to deliver safe, beautiful, elegant justice.
All we need to do is have Democrats act like normal people instead of politicizing every issue there are. Tim Scott knows what needs to be done. It's in a bill. The Senate can pass it today. Democrats are going to block it. Why would you vote for a Democrat unless you want a revolution? But many of them do. AOC and the squad, they are the hard left. They run the Democratic Party. It's not Joe Biden. He's a figurehead, and you need to know that. I'll be right back. Senator Josh Hawley coming up.
There was a time a long, long time ago. Chevys and Levis played on the radio. No cell phones, just 20,000 lights swinging on a Saturday night. All right.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri is one of my favorite senators. But he has exercised over the decision of the United States Supreme Court to interpret the 1964 Civil Rights Act Title VII to include LGBTQ rights within the definition of sex, meaning you cannot discriminate in the employment based upon LGBTQ. And I have been arguing statutory decision, not a big deal. Wait and see what they do in Our Lady of Guadalupe. Josh Hawley, though, did not wait. Josh Hawley has exercised, and because he represents a lot of the conservative legal movement, he went to the Senate floor yesterday. I want you to hear what he had to say. Cut number 15.
I have to say, I agree with the news reports that have said that this is truly a seismic decision. It is truly a historic decision. It is truly a historic piece of legislation. This piece of legislation changes the scope of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It changes the meaning of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It changes the text of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. In fact, you might well argue it is one of the most significant and far-reaching updates to that historic piece of legislation since it was adopted all of those years ago. And make no doubt about it. I mean, make no mistake. This decision, this piece of legislation, will have effects that range from employment law to sports to churches. There's only one problem with this piece of legislation. It was issued by a court, not by a legislature. It was written by judges, not by the elected representatives of the people. And it did what this Congress has pointedly declined to do for years now, which is to change the text and the meaning and the application and the scope of a historic piece of legislation. You know, it's significant, I think, Madam President, for another reason as well. This decision, this Bostock case, and the majority who wrote it, it represents the end of something. It represents the end of the conservative legal movement, or the conservative legal project, as we know it. After Bostock, that effort, as we know it, as it has existed up to now, it's over. And I say this because if textualism and originalism give you this decision, if you can invoke textualism and originalism in order to reach a decision, an outcome that fundamentally changes the scope and meaning and application of statutory law, then textualism and originalism and all of those phrases don't mean much at all. And if those are the things that we've been fighting for, it's what I thought we had been fighting for. Those of us who call ourselves legal conservatives, if we've been fighting for originalism and textualism, and this is the result of that, then I have to say, it turns out we haven't been fighting for very much. Or maybe we've been fighting for quite a lot, but it's been exactly the opposite of what we thought we were fighting for. Now, this is a very significant decision, and it marks a turning point for every conservative, and it marks a turning point for the legal conservative movement. You know, the legal conservative project has always depended on one group of people in particular in order to carry the weight of the votes, to actually support this out in public, to get out there and make it possible electorally. And those are religious conservatives. Now, I am one myself. Evangelicals, conservative Catholics, conservative Jews, they're the ones, let's be honest, they're the ones who have been the core of the legal conservative effort. And the reason for that is, it dates back decades now, back to the 1970s, the reason for that is these religious conservatives from different backgrounds, but what they have consistently sought together was protection for their right to worship, for their right to freely exercise their faith as the First Amendment guarantees, for their right to gather in their communities, for their right to pursue the way of life that their scriptures variously command and that the Constitution absolutely protects. That's what they have asked for. That's what they have sought all these years. But as to those religious conservatives, how do they fare in yesterday's decision? What will this decision mean, this rewrite of Title VII? What will it mean for churches? What will it mean for religious schools? What will it mean for religious charities? Well, in the many pages of its opinion, the majority, 33 pages to be exact, the majority does finally get around to saying something about religious liberty on one page. What does it say? Here's the substance of the court's analysis. How the doctrines protecting religious liberty interact with Title VII, as reinterpreted now by the court, are questions for future cases. Let's have that again. How the doctrines protecting religious liberty interact with Title VII are questions for future cases. Oh, no doubt they are. Huge questions. And we eagerly await what our super legislators across the street in the Supreme Court building there at 1 First Street, how they will legislate on this question. What will become of church hiring liberty? What will become of the policies of religious schools? What will become of the fate of religious charities? Who knows? Who's to say? They're questions for future cases. Now, I will say this in defense of the court. It is difficult to anticipate in one case all future possible implications. That's why courts are supposed to leave legislating to legislators. That's why Article 3 does not give the United States Supreme Court or any federal court the power to legislate, but only the judicial power to decide cases and controversies, not to decide policies. But I will also say this, that everybody knows, every honest person knows, that the laws in this country today, they're made almost entirely by unelected bureaucrats and courts. They're not made by this body. Why not? Because this body doesn't want to make law. That's why not. Because in order to make law, you have to take a vote. In order to vote, you have to be on the record. And to be on the record is to be held accountable. And that's what this body fears above all else, Madam President. This body is terrified of being held accountable for anything on any subject. So can we be so surprised that where the legislature fears to tread, where the Article I body, this body that is charged with the Constitution for legislating, refuses to do its job, courts rush in, and bureaucrats too. Are they accountable to the people? No, not at all. Do we have any recourse? Not really. Now what must we do? Well, now we must wait to see what the super legislators will say about our rights in future cases. If this case makes anything clear, it is that the bargain that has been offered to religious conservatives for years now is a bad one. It's time to reject it. The bargain has never been necessarily explicitly articulated, but religious conservatives know what it is. The bargain is that you go along with the party establishment, you support their policies and priorities, or at least keep your mouth shut about it, and in return, the establishment will put some judges on the bench who supposedly will protect your constitutional rights to freedom of worship, to freedom of exercise. That's been what we're told for years now. If we were told that we're supposed to shut up while the party establishment focuses more on cutting taxes and handing out favors for corporations, multinational corporations who don't share our values, who will not stand up for American principles, who are only too happy to ship American jobs overseas, but we're supposed to say nothing about that. We're supposed to keep our mouths shut because maybe we'll get a judge out of the deal. That was the implicit bargain. We're supposed to keep our mouths shut while the party establishment opens borders, while the party establishment pursues ruinous trade policies. We're supposed to keep our mouths shut while those at the upper end of the income bracket get all of the attention, while working families and college students and those who don't want to go to college but can't get a good job, while they get what? What attention? Workers, children. What about parents looking for help with the cost of raising children? Looking for help with the culture in which they have to raise children, looking for help with the communities, rebuilding the communities in which they must carry out their family life. What about college students trying to find an education that isn't ruinously expensive and then figure out some way to pay back that ruinous debt? What about those who don't have a college degree and don't want one but like to get a good job? What about them? Now, we're supposed to stay quiet about all of that and more because there be pro-constitution religious liberty judges, except that there aren't, except for that these judges don't follow the Constitution, except for these judges invoke textualism and originalism.
Now, look, I think Senator Hawley is extremely talented, smart, may become president someday, and he is not right. I don't know that he's wrong, but he's not right. That's because maybe Thursday, certainly next week, the court is going to decide a case called Our Lady of Guadalupe, which is going to confront the very question of Title VII and religious schools that Senator Hawley raised. Moreover, the judicial project is not over. Moreover, the bargain is defined too narrowly. The bargain has been, what's in it for religious conservatives? National security and originalism. And one judge's single opinion, whatever you think of it. And there is, by the way, an argument that Gorsuch is not wrong. It's not persuasive for many conservatives, but there's an argument that he's not wrong. There is a lot of judging left to be done. And I am afraid that Senator Hawley is encouraging religious conservatives to abandon the field when they've got to take to the field in greater numbers. Court is going to change incredibly. By the way, there have been 51 confirmed, two more in the queue, originalists confirmed to the federal circuit courts, which hear 95% of all cases, and they will restore religious liberty throughout the land. And I believe the Supreme Court will as well protect it in Our Lady of Guadalupe as they did in Hobby Lobby. I believe that will happen. So I believe this is an overstatement and overreaction. It is certainly too quick to draw. And it's passionate. It's articulate. He's a former attorney general. He is a former Chief Justice Roberts clerk. He himself could easily end up going on to the Supreme Court someday, though I think his ambitions are for the Oval Office. And Josh Hawley is extremely talented. But this is too quick, too alarmist, not conservative, and suggests that the game is over when the game is only afoot. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, playing a little bit more of Senator Josh Hawley's overreaction yesterday. And I say this because it's important for people who value religious freedom, freedom of all sort, federalism, structural federalism, Constitution, to not give up on the game because of one decision that they think might be wrong and one misapplication of originalism, which might not be a misapplication. Far too much is at stake for Josh Hawley's pessimism, which is the pessimism of a young man and not the realism of an older man like me. It's nothing compared to Casey, Senator Hawley. When Casey came down and we expected that Roe v. Wade would be repealed, when Casey came down, that was a blow. But you don't stop fighting. You don't give up. You just keep trying to put people on the bench who will apply the Constitution and the laws as they are written with the intent with which they were written by Article 1. Here's the conclusion of Senator Hawley's remarks ripping the court for the Bostock decision authored by Justice Gorsuch 2 days ago. Cut number 16.
Now, I want to be clear. I am not personally criticizing any justice who joined the majority opinion or wrote it. I believe 100% that the justices, the justice who principally authored this opinion, Justice Gorsuch, and those who joined him are sincere and who were writing to the best of their ability, reasoning to the best of their ability. And the opinion is, it is whatever else you might say about it, it is not sloppily reasoned. Now, I think that they were doing what they thought was best and using all of the skills and gifts that they had. No, I question how we got here. I question how judges who hold to this philosophy ended up on that bench. I question the bargain that people of faith have been offered and asked to hold to for all of these years. And the truth is, to those who have said, who have objected to my own questioning of judicial nominees in this body, to those who said I was wrong to question judges who came before the Judiciary Committee, to those who chided me for asking tough questions, even of nominees by a Republican president, for those who said that I was slowing the process down and I was out of line, for the supposedly conservative groups who threatened to buy television time in my own state to punish me for asking questions about conservative judges, I just have this to say. This is why I ask questions. This is why I won't stop. And I wish some more people would ask some harder questions. Because this outcome is not acceptable. And the bargain which religious conservatives have been offered is not tenable.
Stop. So Senator Hawley just said he's a results-oriented conservative. I am not. I am in favor of asking questions, but judges can't answer questions that will commit them before a case is asked. I don't know that anyone thought Justice Gorsuch didn't deserve their vote. And if you understood Justice Hawley correctly, and I did, he is paying homage to Justice Gorsuch's reasoning. It is not without merit. Not how I would have written it. I would have sided with Judge Justice Alito. I believe Chief Justice Roberts cast a strategic vote in order to assign the opinion with to Justice Gorsuch. So I think it is an iconoclastic opinion by an otherwise very reliable judge, and one about which he might change his mind when he deals with the consequences down the road. I thought it was absurd when it was argued, and I thought he was just being theatrical from the bench, but he really has persuaded himself this is correct from a textualist point of view, but it's not. But a one-off doesn't bother me. Tell me what happens, all right, in Our Lady of Guadalupe. And then I expect the senator to take the floor again and say, oops. And by all means, ask all the questions you want. Don't get into a religious test. That is unconstitutional. And only Democrats do that when they say the faith lived deep within you. And be prepared for ongoing serious conversations with nominees because you have to get back to originalism. This, by the way, has almost no consequence. Almost none. Because if you're a freedom and federalism conservative and you care about preserving freedom of all sort, First Amendment freedoms to speak and to assemble and to petition the government, Second Amendment freedoms to own firearms to protect yourself with, Fifth Amendment freedoms on due process and property rights. If you believe in First Amendment freedoms on religious liberty and the right to the free exercise, if you're a federalism person, you believe in structural federalism as a keynote. I have seen nothing from the Roberts Court to alarm me, nothing at all. Only good news. And so I just think it's a little bit of a hair trigger reaction by Senator Hawley, for whom I have great admiration, with whom I've appeared in public, who I know. And I believe, talk to me after Our Lady of Guadalupe comes down. Because if Our Lady of Guadalupe protects with great vigor religious institutions in their hiring practices, and say a religious institution, and this would, by the way, apply for a closely held corporation, religious people and religious organizations don't, for example, Roman Catholics don't have to hire divorced people who remarry. That's that simple to me. If you're a Catholic high school, you cannot be obliged to hire someone who's divorced and remarried. That is the essence of religious liberty, and that is what we need to preserve. Don't go anywhere, America. Hour number two of the Hugh Hewitt Show begins with Steve Kornacki as we talk about the reaction in the polling to defund the police. Democrats want to defund the police. Do you? Stay tuned. I'll be right back.